So, thanks everybody for coming out. The title of the talk that I'm doing today is Linking Newly Diagnosed HIV-Positive Adolescents to Care in 15 United States Clinics, Macro, Meso, and Micro Level Barriers. So this is coming off of the same project that Amanda just presented on. So as you'll understandably so, a lot of the methods are similar, so I'm just going to skim over some of those parts so you don't have to hear the same thing within 10 minutes of each other. Again, I'm a PhD student. There's no financial anything. Acknowledgements. I want to acknowledge Amanda, who we've been working really closely throughout this whole project, as well as the rest of the Adolescent Medicine Trials Network team, the ATN team, that this project is based within. Also, this is Ara Money, and then lastly, the site staff, who have been incredibly patient with our slew of emails, repeated site visits, and so on. So, linkage to care. So, Amanda was talking about it. I'm taking a little bit of a different approach since this is looking at broader structural issues. As she mentioned before, linkage to care is incredibly important for a number of reasons. The first simply being improved health outcomes. If you have a disease like HIV, it's important to be engaged in the medical system. Studies have shown that those who attend more medical clinics, for example, one found people who attend only one as opposed to four medical visits, have a nearly two times adjusted likelihood of death because, again, they're not getting medication, their viral load and CD4 counts are not being monitored. So there's that specific issue. Also from the broader community perspective as well, those who are not in care have higher viral loads, transmission is more likely. And secondly, it's important in terms of engaging people in broader medical and social services. So, for example, meeting with social workers for things like housing or GED programs, getting mental health addressed is also important for these adolescents. Again, for those of you that have read the National HIV/AIDS Strategy that came out last year, there has been an increased focus on test and treat strategy, and the focus is on testing and treating and the seamless linkage. However, this notion of seamless linkage, the sort of buzzword that keeps coming up, it's still unclear the best way to do that. And a lot of times organizations are now being told they need to have this program, but it's not clear what that program will look like. So that's one of the things we wanted to explore within this. So we're looking at structural barriers to care, just to throw out the definition that we've been sort of playing with in our heads as we're doing this, is using structural barriers to refer to factors that impede HIV-related care originating in the social, economic, and political environments that shape and constrain individual health behaviors. So within structural barriers, we're taking it at three levels, the macro, meso, and micro level. So macro, like any, when you think of general structural barriers, it's issues like stigma, homelessness, whether or not someone is employed, insurance, even getting to the clinic itself. The meso is a little bit more similar to the clinic level. So who are the staff at the clinic? Is the clinic a place the adolescents even want to go? What does that space look like? Where is it? Is it somewhere they can get to? And then the micro level is more the adolescent themselves, issues of adolescent development, willingness, like Amanda said, to even show up in the clinic and be a part of their own care. And then something that complicates this specifically for adolescents is, linkage to care is difficult for adults in general, but in terms of a developmental period, adolescence is rough for just about anything. Anyone who's a parent knows that, or has, we've obviously gone through it. So trying to get to receive something like this type of illness diagnosis as an adolescent complicates things even further. Also, as we've been talking about, there's a structural fragmentation between testing and care sites, and adolescents are more likely to be diagnosed in community settings. And so where they get diagnosed and where they end up receiving care, oftentimes it is different people, it is a different physical space, and so it makes it even more difficult to have that streamlined approach to getting them into care. And not surprisingly, rates of linkage to care from community settings to clinics are lower than for people who just get tested in clinics. And many of these adolescents grow up without a history of going to the doctor and being engaged in clinical care in general, so having to start that process is very difficult. So background on the SMILE program, the overly long name that Amanda read for you once, you don't have to hear it again, Project SMILE. It grew out of a partnership between the National Institute of Child Health and Development, the Center for Disease Control, and then the Adolescent Trials Network. So again, there are 15 clinical sites. These sites are everywhere from San Francisco, LA, Memphis, Puerto Rico, New York. They're spread out throughout the United States. This program was implemented at all 15 sites. So positions for an outreach worker whose job, we basically said, it is your job to link adolescents to care. How that was implemented at the different sites varied. So everything from people who are out in the community every single day working with organizations to a more structural level within the health department sort of tracking people. So the sites had latitude to implement it as they wanted. And then a linkage to care coordinator who oversaw the outreach worker and did a lot more of the administrative stuff. As well, as Amanda mentioned, there are memorandum of understanding between the health departments and the sites that described how the information flow would go, whether or not people would get specific names of those who were newly diagnosed or just general aggregate information. And then also they had formal collaborations with different community organizations. So the purpose of this paper is to look at the structural barriers to HIV-related care for adolescents, and then to provide suggestions of how to alleviate these. So first to understand them and then see what we can actually do about it. So Amanda and I, over the last couple of years, overall there'll be three visits, a baseline year one and year two. We've so far completed two rounds of them, visited all 15 of these sites for 2 to 3 days each, and interviewed everyone from the, at each site, the outreach worker and the linkage to care coordinator was interviewed, but also social workers, case managers, doctors, nurses, anybody at the site that's engaged with linkage to care. And we really wanted to try to get as many different viewpoints as we could, both from the SMILE staff, but just in general, since many of these people have been working for, 20, 25 years with this population. And so these interviews were digitally recorded, transcribed, in case of Puerto Rico, translated as well. And we read through them and then began coding. The coding process grew out of both what we had learned from the literature, the data itself, and then was a very much an iterative process because the site visits were spaced out over the course of about 3 to 4 months. So we were able to talk about them as we went, I guess, and update some of the questions. We used, it's called the Dynamic Social Systems Model. It came out of a group that Carl Atkin works on last year, which looks at structural barriers to different factors related to HIV. They looked predominantly at testing. And so we adapted it to look at this. And then analytically, we did a constant comparative method looking across sites and then now across time as well to look at how these different barriers were described. So as a result, we took these three levels of cultural barriers and then applied them specifically to what came out from the interviews. And some of the interview questions we specifically said, what is difficult for you, but a lot of it we didn't even have to ask. We'd say just generally, how is linkage to care going? And immediately people would launch into especially sort of the structural issues like insurance and transportation. So here, the three main categories, and there are actually, as you can imagine, plenty of other barriers. These were the main ones that came up across sites and that were consistent across the United States. So, for example, there are three sites in Florida, so there are certain issues that are specific to Florida because of state-specific policies. And if you've been following some of the issues with ADAP, the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, the waiting list in Florida is about 50% of what's in the U.S. So, for example, that state has some specific issues, but these were ones that came across all 15 sites. So one of the major ones was insurance availability, and even if it was available, making sure the adolescent had the paperwork to access it. Broader relationships between the clinics, the health departments, the testing organizations. I'm sure most of you or many of you have worked in the community, and there are plenty of issues with TERF and who gets what money and who works with who and who doesn't like who, and so throwing an outreach worker position into that, there are definitely some barriers with getting that started. On the meso level, the clinic, definitely issues with personnel and then procedural within the clinic, getting the program up and running, and then on the micro level, where the adolescents themselves were. So I'm not going to read these quotes to you directly, but this one's looking at insurance barriers, and one of the sites was saying that, what do you do if Medicaid or the insurance company is saying, well, you have to show proof of residence, you have to show a bill. A lot of these kids are 16, they're living with their parents don't know. So how are they going to get these documentations? So the insurance fell into three different, basically, categories of barriers. The first being the sort of pragmatic of the process of the application, mm-hmm. getting adequate documentation, or delays in getting documents. So many of the states, you need proof of residence, which oftentimes would be the form of a bill or an ID. A lot of 16-year-olds do not have a state ID. They don't know where their birth certificate is. You need to show proof of income. Again, a lot of these adolescents don't have it, so they'll try to be like rummaging through their parents' drawers, looking through their parents' proof of insurance. So there's issues with that, also getting downtown to even get to the place to sit there for 3 hours to try to give all this documentation and give it to the Ryan White people. The second is eligibility related. So oftentimes for older males, it was a little bit more difficult to get insurance as opposed to people under the age of 18 or women, or especially pregnant women, it tended to be much easier. And then lastly, for those that already had insurance, but it was their parents' insurance, but they had yet to disclose, that actually ended up being one of the largest barriers. So some adolescents would just wait it out until they became 18 because they were unwilling to disclose. So you can see for the solution that was talking about here is what they would do oftentimes is use Ryan White, other grants and donations to cover people who either did not have insurance or who were on their parents' insurance. So again, I mean, as they say, you can see in the last bit, kind of a variety of hodgepodge of grants. It's not an ideal solution, but it's what many of the clinics ended up working with. For system-wide related barriers, as you can see, I mean, it starts out agencies are about numbers. And so there were a lot of issues that came up about TURF and willingness to work together. A lot of agencies were afraid they were going to lose funding. There was this idea that this outreach worker was coming in to take their clients. A lot of this came down to simply understanding that the job of the outreach worker was simply to link kids to care. It didn't matter where they were linked. It didn't matter who they ended up seeing. It was simply getting them into care. And so it's been improving once that's become understood. But again, especially now when funding is so incredibly difficult and tight, people are really worried about giving over any sort of information. So you can see with the solution for this site in particular, it was just getting the outreach worker in the community and getting her on board, like coalitions and boards, and going to all the partner agencies and showing what she was doing and explaining it and just showing her face and emailing and getting her involved so people began to know, I say her, they're all but two of them are women, and trust her more closely. And then looking at some of the meso-related barriers for the personnel issues, oftentimes this came down, so this is saying, you know, I have one transgender youth who feels more comfortable as a female. And so this issue of, that's great once you get into the clinic and are with the providers, but they're still showing up at the front desk, and how do the front desk staff feel about this? And so especially for clinics that are either located within a hospital, so you have to check into the broader hospital system first, you're walking through the hospital as a transgender individual, or oftentimes space was shared. So say you have a pediatric clinic with, you know, five-year-old, you know, kids who are five and coming in for a healthy child visit, and their parents are in the waiting room, and you have a 23-year-old, you know, trans female, oftentimes there'll be this tension, and so the clients feel it, the providers know it, so it's this question of how you deal with that. And so a lot of the sites ended up doing training specifically with the front desk, training with the providers that say we're not HIV specific or we're not adolescent providers, trying to get them to understand what some of these patients needed. Again, one of them, I mentioned this earlier, integrating the SMILE project into the broader clinic space, because much of the outside agencies are worried about numbers, many of the providers were protective of their own adolescents and were wary to have somebody else coming in and helping them with their job. This was more prominent with the social workers and the case managers. So one of the outreach workers, as you can see, was saying, you know, she spent the first 6 months basically filling out forms because they didn't really want her going out and meeting with the clients. Excuse me, they didn't know her background, they didn't trust her. So what ended up happening is that it was almost a year-long process of the linkage to care coordinator, the outreach worker, meeting with them, getting involved in any small way that she could, just providing transportation until they began to trust her and understand what she was capable of, and then slowly she was able to meet with the adolescents earlier on. So micro barriers, again, as you might imagine, for adolescents that feel healthy, one of the major things is simply being ready to engage in care, and they're not ready to accept that they're HIV positive oftentimes. Coming into the clinic, especially clinics that are HIV only, may mean that they're surrounded by people that look sicker or by people they know. And so one of the ways that people talked about addressing that was a lot of the site staff said, you know, it's totally fine, you don't have to come. Like, some of them would call them every week just to check in and say hi, they'd send them text messages, or the adolescents might come and meet with a social worker and get housing. And so they were telling stories of adolescents that would show up for 2 years and would not talk to a doctor or a nurse, but would just hang out in the clinic, and then slowly but surely made that transition. So it's very much acknowledging that for adolescents, a lot of stuff just takes more time than it might otherwise. But being there so when the adolescent is ready, they can call and engage. So to reiterate what Amanda had mentioned earlier, I mean, linkage to care is essential for everybody. That's never a question. It's especially so for adolescents, both challenging but especially important because of the fact that they are younger, so they're going to have to be engaged in care for the entirety of their lifespan. So getting them in and getting them in a place where they feel comfortable with it is important. And also, again, on a community level, if you can get people in care and get them on medication, it's much less likely from a public health perspective for the virus to spread throughout the community. And so the sort of question of, great, we have these barriers, what do we do with it? So on the macro level, you know, you can look at policy issues. For insurance, some of the sites, one in Florida, for example, has changed one of the requirements that you need for paperwork to bring. So just little things like that to try to make it even easier to get access. And again, working with the health department and clinics to facilitate those relationships and make them even stronger, which will help that seamless transition. On the meso level, a lot of it is figuring out where clinics are, maybe getting a space that is adolescent specific, so you don't have peds and adolescent clinics that are overlapping, training of the personnel, and then again on the micro level, having providers that understand what it means to be an adolescent and have adolescent specific training. Limitations, some of them that were mentioned earlier. This is focused on the SMILE program staff. As Amanda mentioned, through IRB, we were not able to talk to the health department staff nor the adolescents themselves. So that's a next step that would be really important to hear what they have to say and if these barriers that we're finding resonate at all with them. And again, as I said, this program will continue, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not some of these barriers become alleviated on their own over time as the program is integrated into the community and into the clinic itself. So lastly, again, these structural barriers are important. I mean, as much as an adolescent may say this is what they want and they're ready to get into care, there are likely issues or potential issues that are bigger than they can handle on their own. Secondly, one thing that I do want to stress is it's important to match the level of solution to the level of barrier. So for example, when I was talking earlier about adolescents coming in without insurance, creating this hodgepodge of grants to cover them, it's great for an individual adolescent, it's not sustainable over time, and it's not really actually fixing any problem. So, or on the flip side, you mean one could say if an adolescent's not ready for care, you can't isolate them, you can't stick them in quarantine, you can't say you have to come or else, it doesn't work like that. So how do you match the actual structural level barrier to a potential solution? And again, simply saying structural barriers, they're not their own entity. Within that, I mean, there are, you know, policy level, clinic level, adolescent level, so it's much less straightforward than we might like, but at the same time, it's important to understand that when moving forward. Thank you, guys. Any questions? Yeah, there have been some studies that have, and it's actually, there's very little research to be honest on this, so I'm saying when I say studies, it's a mix of studies and just anecdotally what we've heard talking to people. Some studies have shown that adolescents, or I'm sure people in general, tend to form a bond with the person that provides them with their first diagnosis. And so if there's that first person, all of a sudden they know something about you, there's some established trust, and then that person says, great, this is all I do, this, you know, here's a card, or all of a sudden that first trust is broken and the adolescent has to reestablish that with everyone else, whereas if it's in a clinical setting, oftentimes that person, they will still see them in the clinic every day, they can go with them to their medical visit. So I think it's both that sort of emotional connection, but a lot of it is simply logistics. So if someone is tested at a bar at 2 in the morning, and then you wake up the next day and it's like, oh, now I have to find this clinic, I don't know what my, I think just there's so many unknowns for them. So I think a lot of it is just simply, if you're already tested in that clinical space, it means that you already got yourself there, you know where it is, you've met individuals there. But again, I mean, there hasn't been as much research done as there probably should be, especially considering how much we're always pushing for outreach and doing everything out in the community. And obviously the testing is important, but getting people into care is as well.